please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Well, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. I'm a mind reader. Yeah, I knew exactly what you were thinking. The book of Leviticus. What do livers and kidneys have to do with me? And is it really worth it getting up early in the morning on a snowy day to hear about livers and kidneys? Am I a mind reader? Or am I the only one who's... Well, actually, the title of my message this morning is What's So Great About the Book of Leviticus? And Dave anticipated a little bit of what I wanted to say to you today, because the book is really very, very important. Although the details can be elusive, because the book is intended for the Kohanim, the priests, it is elusive to us, but nonetheless has a powerful and important message. I remember I was at Dave and Serena's house, it was a few months ago now, and I picked up a book this thick of David's computer programming. Have you ever looked at one of those books before? I have read this book, I couldn't make out a word. It's the quote, the Indian for the Frisco kid. It was just impossible to penetrate, and yet I asked him about it, and he said, oh no, I really get into that. I'm thinking, man, what's the plot? Where's it going? But he loves it. And Leviticus is that way also. A little difficult to penetrate because it's highly technical. It's intended for the priests so that they do the right things, get everything right in the Mishkan. But again, the book is important. Now, I'd like to distill for you this morning why the book is so important, but in order to do that, you have to indulge me. I must tell you about a fabulous article that was in the day before yesterday's New York Times. It was by David Brooks, and it's called The Strange Persistence of Guilt. I'm not going to read you the whole article, but let me just read you a little bit, because you'll see why it's very relevant to our question, what's so great, what's so important about the book of Leviticus. He says this, "We still use words describing virtue and vice, but without any overall metaphysics. Religious frameworks no longer organize public debate. Secular philosophies that grew out of the Enlightenment have fallen apart. We have words and emotional instincts about what feels right and wrong, but no settled criteria by which to help us think, argue, and decide. You'd think all this confusion would lead to a blasé live and let live culture, but that's not what happened," says David Brooks. "We haven't, get this now, we have not entered the age of milquetoast bourgeois relativism. Instead, society has become a free-form demolition derby of moral confrontation. The bold fanaticisms of students at Middlebury College," do you know what that's referring to, by the way? Yeah, awful. Thursday night, there was happened to be a conservative gentleman who was just giving a talk, and students surrounded the car, attacked, one of them attacked the lady who was accompanying him, the teacher from the college. It was a horrible moment, but it's illustrative of this point that the author is making. So we become a demolition derby of moral confrontation, what happened at Middlebury College and other campuses nationwide. Holy wars over transgendered bathrooms, the furious intensity all over town hall meeting, at every town meeting on every subject. American life has secularized, and grand political ideologies have gone away, but moral conflict has only grown. In fact, he says, it's the people who go to church least who seem the most fervent moral crusaders. What he's talking about here is, again, that there's a breakdown and there's no common way of understanding issues of right and wrong. And so everyone is into strong feelings of what they're so sure about, and the level of confrontation has escalated without any way out of it. And it goes on in the article to talk about the fact that part of the problem and part of the energy behind all this hostility is that all of us, because we're aware of so much of what goes on, are keenly aware of our own inadequacy. We're constantly confronted with social problems from around the world, and we know we don't do enough to solve them. We're constantly faced with every kind of issue that deserves our attention and our involvement, and yet we know that we can only do so much, and it makes us feel guilty. And the guilt, then, he goes on to say, results, the only way to handle that guilt, because, you know, there's no other way to handle it, is that people get into blame shifting. Everything is a kind of victim mentality. And people adopt a victim mentality. I have to deal with my guilt somehow for not doing enough for the world. And the way collectively people do it is to just say, well, I'm a victim. It's not my fault. It's your fault. And hence the kind of confrontation that we have been discussing. I want to suggest to you, I'll read you just this last section here, where he really leads us to the book of Leviticus without having to say a thing. He says this, and this is the New York Times, listen. Sin is a stain, a weight, and a debt, but at least religions offer people a path from self-reflection to confession to atonement and absolution. Mainstream culture has no clear path upward from guilt, either for individuals or groups. So you get a buildup of scapegoating, shaming, and Manichaean confrontation. What that refers to, when you hear the word Manichaean, it means black or white. Everything is black or white, good or evil, and everyone's fighting as a way of blaming everybody else to assuage this collective guilt which has nowhere to go. And I want to show you this morning, for the next few minutes, a better way, which is the way of the book of Leviticus, and how that book takes us in a direction as Messianic Jews, which is truly wonderful. Now, Leviticus is difficult. It's like that computer language that we talked about before, but what is its basic message? Okay? The basic message is that there is a kind of drama that God has established, a kind of sacred drama, a set of steps so that we can move from this sense of guilt and inadequacy, because we know we're never as good as we should be, right? Right? There's a way forward from that, and that's the way that our society doesn't have, per David Brooks' comments. Guilt is real, says the book of Leviticus, but it's not the main thing. There is a way back to God. And therefore, when we read about livers and entrails and kidneys and all this other stuff that seems so irrelevant, if we step back and look at the larger picture, it's very, very relevant, because all of it is part of this sacred drama involving priests and animals and people whereby forgiveness is procured for Israel. Do you follow what I'm saying so far? Okay, you get the idea? It's really, really important. And we see this idea of forgiveness offered by God through a means, through a way, through, again, we call it a sacred drama, but it's not just a psychological thing. There's a vertical element. There's a supernatural element in the entire equation, which culminates in what Yeshua is all about. So I want to talk with you a little about Yeshua. You see, Yeshua was a great teacher, And he taught Torah, and that's important. And Yeshua was a great example of how to live, not just what he said, but what he did. The power of the Ruach resting him that we at Ruach hope to get a little piece of per our healing prayer initiative. But Yeshua's purpose for coming culminates during Pesach, we happen to be in that season right now, when he is arrested because people didn't like this, him going around and doing what he was doing. And when he was in Jerusalem, arrested, tried, convicted falsely, and where he ended up on that execution stake, the ultimate expression of what the book of Leviticus is all about. The book of Leviticus gets us ready. It has its own value and meaning per what we're discussing, but it points to someone. And that someone is Yeshua. And so he gives himself, and we ask why. What is the meaning of what he did? And related to that, what is the mechanism? How does God do something with what Yeshua did? And so I'll take a few minutes just to share some dimensions of it with you. Number one, his giving himself, and this is something that was emphasized in the early community of Yeshua for a few centuries, but is not as emphasized now and probably shouldn't be thought of as the main thing. But there's a sense in which when Israel and when we do bad things, it gives the forces of darkness a kind of stake in us. There's a sense in which the evil one can say, see, look at the trajectory of her life. She's mine. Or him, obviously. And Yeshua comes and offers himself so that we can have whatever tie there might be along those lines just broken. We belong to God and not to the forces of darkness. Now again, that was something that was emphasized more in the early centuries, and it's not the main thing in the Bible and in our Messianic Jewish understanding, but it's not to be trivialized. There's a sense in which Yeshua giving himself has something to do with breaking the power of the evil one in our world and his claim on individuals, on groups, ultimately on the entire world. So there is another element that's really important, and that is that in some mysterious way, justice had to be satisfied in the universe. Now, we don't understand the nature of this, and theologians have bent over backwards to articulate this with a lot of clarity. However, I'm not sure it's all so clear. I don't want to commend to you any particular model of how this occurs. All I know is this. There's a sense in which the evil that we choose to do has got to go somewhere. There's a judicial element in the process. Someone has to pay for this some way. And Yeshua steps up to the plate and says, I'll do it. I'll do it. I lay down my life. I have the power to take it up again, Yeshua says, because of this need for a kind of divine justice to be satisfied. And this is the one I want to emphasize for you just for the next few minutes. Yeshua's self-sacrifice is an example of something that really is important. Now, let me step out of our world a little bit here. And I want to suggest to you, you know, I read a lot of mainstream stuff, and I also listen to stuff on the not mainstream news. I think truth is a matter of involving ourselves in both, so I read the New York Times most every day, but I read other things too. And what we're going to likely find in the years ahead is some kind of disclosure, maybe you've heard of this, about the whole UFO phenomenon. Maybe you've heard about this or maybe not. And the idea is that some people allege that what's going to happen is that the United States government has not been, and the world governments have not been entirely forthcoming about all the evidence that there really might be beings that God has created elsewhere. Personally, if it's true, and I'm not going to commit myself, I don't know for sure, but if it's true, I say no biggie. God, who loves to create different kinds of trees and animals and kitty cats and people, he loves to create, if he wants to create beings that are sentient and intelligent and from other places, does that detract from his love for us? Not to me at all, not in the slightest. Not threatened by it in the slightest. Not ready to commit myself to think for sure one way or the other. But let's say, hypothetically, 5 years from now, you're here and you're remembering this message, and there was a disclosure that from the planet Oog, there are intelligent beings, okay? Some people, and I've seen this already in some of the materials, are looking to whatever great intelligences are out there to save us from ourselves. But the problem is, if there are such beings, we have no idea what their intentions are, what they're like. We have no real reason for trusting anything like that. But when it comes to Yeshua, what we see is that the supreme power of the universe loves, and loves sacrificially. See, this is the main point. There are people out there, and this we know for an absolute fact, who are Satanists and people who believe in the occult and want to believe in Lucifer, and you've heard of this kind of stuff. And I say to them, man, are you missing the boat? Because the only one that showed that at the end of the day, at the essence of all things, is love for humanity, is this Yeshua who gave himself so that we can be pardoned and so that Israel could be restored and that all could be well in the world. I'm betting on Yeshua, and I want to encourage you to as well. He is the one, and no spacemen or other esoteric beings or whatever there might be can cut it. But it's the one on this snowy day who you've chosen, bravo, to get out of bed and exalt the God of Israel and his Messiah, Yeshua. He is the one. You see, he's the one who is our way back from our darker selves. We don't have to blame shift. We don't need to scapegoat. We don't have to become angry. We just have to bow in humble gratitude to God for his sacrifice, the sacrifice of Messiah, and then go and do good things. So let's go and do good things. Shabbat shalom, everyone.
In the mouths of the house of Israel, and may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those who know your name and study your Torah for Messiah.